be not afraid. The isle is full of noises, sounds and sweet airs that give delight, and hurt not. Sometimes a thousand twangling instruments will hum about my ears, and sometimes voices. What? I'm Fanny Kemble, English born and English died, from the most English of English theatrical families, the Kemble-Siddons family. I made my theatrical debut as Juliet in Romeo and Juliet at the Covent Garden Theatre in London in 1829. I was a great success. I saw shop windows filled with sketches of me, saucers with pictures of me on them. Gentlemen wore buff-coloured handkerchiefs with lavender silhouettes at my head, and ladies wore Kemble curls. Alas, fame is not the same as fortune. The promise of American box office receipts lured me and my father across the great dividing ditch of the Atlantic Ocean for a tour of the northern cities. The New York Evening Post said that I was perfect, that a more brilliant performance had never been seen on the New York stage, and that my presence would raise and refine the American style. People flocked to see me. We went to New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston. They cheered and they showered the stage with roses. Wherever I performed, a handsome Philadelphia gentleman followed me. He attended every performance. He waited at the stage door. He took me riding. He sent me nosegays. It was the golden time of my existence. In the spring of 1834, I gave over my American earnings for the support of my parents in their old age. I announced my decision to leave the stage and to marry my Philadelphia friend, Mr. Pierce Butler. I knew he was not intellectually brilliant, but I found him charming, and I thought his moral faculties were excellent and strong. Soon after my marriage, my husband inherited extensive rice and cotton plantations at the mouth of the Altamaha River in the Sea Islands of Georgia. The family into which I married were large slaveholders. When I married Pierce Butler, I knew nothing of these possessions. I had an English woman's prejudice against slavery, but I expected to find much kindness on the part of the master and much contentment on the part of the slaves. At my earnest entreaties, I visited these plantations. I traveled with my husband and our two baby daughters, Sally and Fan, and our faithful Irish nursemaid, Marjorie O'Brien, in the winter of 1838. As we neared the low, reedy banks of Butler Island, the steersman took up a huge conch. In the barbaric fashion of ancient times, sounded out our approach, and the sedges, a profusion of waterfowl, startled us. Now the wharf, a crowd of negroes, jumped and danced, they clapped their hands and whistled and cried out, "Massa, Massa, how you do? Oh, missy, he's so glad to see you." The landing, the coin pushed and dragged, and then it lifted into the air on the canvas bridge too. I seemed to close and kiss them, put back their hands, and they were there. I believe I was almost afraid. Our demeanor continued contained several thousand acres. The whole island was really swamp, surrounded by dikes. It was said to be one of the largest rice plantations in America. On all sides lay the marshy rice fields and swampy patches of yet unreclaimed forest. Huge cypress trees and exquisite green undergrowth sprang up from stagnant, sweltering pools. Here, the magnolia grew to the size of a forest tree. Amphibious creatures, alligators, serpents, and a profusion of birdlife, mockingbirds, and blackbirds, and scarlet and indigo birds I couldn't name. And then the sky, the unspeakable glories of these southern heavens. There was no master's dwelling, as no master had been in residence for over two generations. And in consequence, we inhabited the cottage used by our overseer. It consisted of three rooms, one for sitting and eating, one for our bedroom, and an attic chamber for Marjorie O'Brien and the babies. It was devoid of conveniences and adornments, such being our abode. There was little danger of my being dazzled by the splendors of a southern slave residence. That first morning, the overseer presented our servants to us, those who'd been selected to wait upon us in the house. Our housekeeper, Molly, known as Old House Molly, to distinguish her from all of the other Mollies on the estate, and our cook, John, tolerable one he was too, I do believe there's a natural talent among them. And our footmen, waiters, two lads, 15 or 16 years old, Hector and Alexander. When I first met them, their faces and hands and clothes and naked feet were so encrusted with dirt that their attendance on our table was not particularly agreeable to me. A young woman named Psyche, commonly known as Sack, served as a sort of under-nursemaid, an assistant to our Marjorie. The presence of Marjorie O'Brien caused considerable confusion on Butler Island. The people had no idea of a white person performing any of the duties of a servant. They spoke of her as the other Missy. And me? As the Rat Missy. There were no sleeping quarters in our house for our house slaves. On southern plantations, servants never slept under the same roof with their masters. If duties required their attendance at sick bed or cradle, they were permitted to pass the night on the floor. Nor were there any accommodations for their meals in our house. No time, no place was set aside for them to eat. Consequently, they congregated at all hours in the cooking shed, where they stood or squatted by the fire, picking at whatever was left from the master's table. With the exception of our house servants, the slaves were divided into gangs, such was the honorable term. There were gangs of field hands, who were the majority, and gangs of artisans who were exceedingly expert at their trades. There was a gang of bricklayers, and a gang of blacksmiths who made all of the iron implements for field and hearth that were used on the estate, and a gang of carpenters, and a gang of coopers who made all of the wooden barrels that were used for our rice crop. Oh, and they also made wonderfully fragrant cedar tubs and buckets for the use of the people. Cooper, London, the head cooper, was the people's preacher. The people on this plantation were not permitted to go to the mainland for church except once a month. And on the other Sundays, they assembled at Cooper London's cabin, where he led them in prayer and read the Bible to them. I'm gonna huts on the island. Each consists of a dozen or so cabins and a cook shop where the daily rations are boiled in huge cauldrons. Soon after my arrival, I called at one of the cabins. I entered the main room. It was about 12 by 15 feet, with two tiny closets for sleeping. Two large families, one of 7 people and one of 10 people, resided in it. A group of half-naked children, all with babies on their backs, cowered around 2 or 3 cinders. When the mothers are in the field, the older children act as little nurses. They watch over the babies and carry them to the mothers to be nourished. I proclaimed to all the little nurses that I would give 1 cent to each child whose baby's face should be clean, and 1 cent more to each child with clean hands and face of his or her own. My appeal was fully comprehended by the majority. And subsequently, whenever I emerged from my front door, I was surrounded by swarms of children, their little charges on their backs, all with shining, and in many cases still wet, faces and hands. Thus did I ingeniously contrive to introduce bribery and corruption into the island. The steel-driven machine which shelled the rice was under the supervision of a slave named Ned, Engineer Ned. Ned was an uncommonly youthful-looking man. He attributed his appearance to never having been exposed to brutish field work. At the head of each field gang was a black driver. The task system was in force, and each day the driver assigned a task to each man and woman under him. The tasks were professed to be graduated according to sex, age, and strength, but in practice, the men and women had the same burdens, a noble admission of female equality. The head driver was Headman Frank. When the overseer was absent from the estate, as he frequently was, Headman Frank was sole governor of the island. He appointed the work, he pronounced punishments, he exercised undisputed mastery over his fellow slaves, yet he remained just as much a slave as any of the rest. Under the law, he could be flogged by the overseer, or sold like a cart horse by the master. I often saw him looking over the broad river, which was for him as a prison wall. The man Frank's wife was Betty, a tidy, trim, sad-looking woman with a pretty figure. And their youngest son was Renty, a lad with a light complexion and a decided air of superiority. The overseer was a man of extraordinary energy and activity. He was the only white man living on the island, and he directed the destinies of 700 slaves. The slaves on this estate consider themselves well off. They're not hired out to other masters, they're not bought and sold, members of families are not parted for life, they're not brutally beaten. Rules of punishment on Butler Island had been laid down many years before by Pierce's grandfather. In the field, the driver was allowed to inflict a dozen lashes upon any refractory slave at the time of the offense. The headman had the power to inflict 3 dozen lashes at his own discretion, the overseer up to 50, and as for the master, there were no limits. The slaves on this estate are regularly fed 2 meals a day, rice and corn grits. They're provided with clothing. Every year, each slave is given 2 pairs of shoes and several yards of flannel. They're given tolerable habitation, and there's an infirmary for their care. As soon as I learned there was an infirmary, I determined to visit it at once. The infirmary was a large barn-like building of whitewashed wood. The enormous fireplace glowed, powerless embers of a few sticks and some 24 women huddled about it. They lay prostrate on the floor, without bed or mattress or pillow. Some expected at every hour the agonies of childbirth, and some groaned from the anguish of miscarriage. Some had just brought their doomed offspring into the world. I stood in the midst of them, perfectly unable to speak. The tears poured from my eyes. When I recovered myself, I addressed old Rose, the midwife in charge of the room, and I bade her open the shutters of such windows as were glazed. I then proceeded to make up the fire. But upon my lifting a log, there was a universal outcry of horror. Let alone, missy! Let be! What for you lift log, missy? You got nigger enough to do that! Well, among the sick women, I recognized a tall, gaunt negress who had embraced Sally and Fan with much zeal upon our arrival. Her name was Charlotte. Besides being ill herself, she was nursing a sick baby. I addressed remonstrances to her about the horribly dirty condition of her child, and she assured me she had no time to keep any of her children clean. And she went out to work at daybreak and did not complete her task until night. And then she was too worn out to do anything but throw herself down and sleep. I left this refuge for our sick dependents with my clothes filled with dirt and filled with vermin. I returned home, and I described my chagrin to Pierce and to the overseer. The overseer told me that the condition of the infirmary had appeared to him to require reform, and he had proposed it. But receiving no encouragement, had assumed it was a matter of indifference to the elders. I mentioned Charlotte's statement about not having time to keep her babies clean. The overseer assured me it was not true. The next day, I went again to the infirmary, and there had indeed been some faint attempt at cleaning the place. Charlotte, however, was crying bitterly. When I asked her what ailed her, she informed me, more by signs than words, that the overseer had flogged her. Why? For having complained to me that she had not time to keep her babies clean. After that, I went to the infirmary every single day. I bathed women and I washed babies. I removed fleas from black bodies and lice from woolly heads. I cleaned infected arms and legs, and I washed stumps of what had once been hands and feet. For exercise, I rowed a small boat, and on one occasion, I rowed to a remote settlement where some of the oldest slaves, those who would not die, were sent to be out of the way. One very aged woman spoke to me of Pierce's grandfather and of the early days of the plantation when she was young and strong. She told me that she still deserved to be kept. Oh, me no longer able to work, missy. I made plenty little nigger for you and master. She followed up this with a request for a bit of sugar. I was constantly besieged by petitioners. In the house, no time, no place afforded me respite, and whenever I walked out, they surrounded me. Suki, Kwambo's wife, came to implore that the rule be altered which sends the women back into the field 3 weeks after they give birth. She had had 2 miscarriages, 4 children born, and all but her new baby were dead. Young Morris, the blacksmith, asked permission to be baptized. Betty, headman Frank's wife, had come with a similar request. She told me that she had several times asked the overseer for permission for the ceremony and had never been able to obtain it. Dorcas, Bush's wife, came complaining of weakness in the back and incessant flooding. She asked that her field workload be lightened. I referred these requests to my husband, although he complained that I ought not listen to such trash from the darkies. Sarah, Stephen's wife, two miscarriages, crippled with rheumatism, was with child again. Chloe, Israel's wife, three miscarriages, two children born, one of whom died. Leah, Caesar's wife, six children born, three dead. Hannah, Abraham's wife, two miscarriages, with child again. Venus, Jack's wife, six children born.
Yeah, what is this I see? Cool as the hands all over me. He says, I am dead and no one can excel.
Many of the petitioners I was able to satisfy myself. Alexander, our waiter, came with a special request. Alec was an uncommonly bright lad, and under my tutelage he had become a first-rate footman. He asked me to teach him to read. I wanted to do it, but it would have been quite simply breaking the law. The penalties for teaching a slave to read were very severe. Heavy fines, imprisonment, even death. Unrighteous laws, however, are made to be broken. I did teach Alec to read. Renty came asking to be relieved of field work and to be allowed to learn a trade, citing his white blood. I said, what do you mean, Renty, your white blood? Who is your mother? Betty? Headman Francois? Who is your father? The overseer? Did your mother tell you so? No. The other children told me. I suspect they know. Old Rose confirmed the story. And she told me of her granddaughter who had attempted to run away. Old Rose said. What for me to run away? The small boy around? They get in there. They starve to death. Will the snakes eat them up? Mrs. Nigger, they don't never run away. Mrs. Nigger, they don't never run away. I was getting perfectly savage at such things. I really thought I should consider my own throat and those of my children well cut if some night the people decided to clear off scores in that fashion. I wonder they do not rise up like Caliban and howl. Farewell, master. Farewell. Farewell. No more dams I'll make for fish, nor fetch in firing. Requiring more scrape trench ring, nor wash dish. Bang, bang, cacao, bang. Got no master, got no man. Freedom, hiding, hiding, freedom, freedom, hiding, freedom. Shadrach was seized with pneumonia. The doctor came repeatedly from the mainland. One night, Mr. Butler himself watched with him. Shadrach sank rapidly, and after 3 days, he died. That evening, as twilight thickened into darkness, I went with Mr. Butler to the cabin of Cooper London. A large assemblage of the people had gathered outside. around the coffin which lay on trestles. Many of the men carried pine torches, the fitful glare glancing over the strange assembly. The first high wailing notes of a hymn sung by the whole congregation sent a thrill through all my nerves. Cooper London proclaimed the everlasting covenant of freedom and of the resurrection of the life. All people knelt. I felt awe, pity, and wonder at finding myself on this soil, surrounded by my slaves, in the presence of the dead man and the living God. Mr. Butler alone remained standing. He told me that niggers are all damn liars, and I was a fool to believe anything they told me. He refused to receive any more petitions through me. He ordered me to listen to no more requests and to cease meddling in the business of the estate. I was not born among slaves, and I could not live among them, condemned to see and hear such misery without the means to alleviate it, without the right even to present it for alleviation. I then perceived that the physical misery of the slave has his counterpart, the moral wretchedness of the master. I had seen what few Englishmen had ever seen, the workings of the slavery system from the midst of it. I considered it my duty to make known what I had witnessed. Mr. Butler presented to the Court of Common Pleas of the City of Philadelphia a prayer for absolute divorce from the bond of matrimony. He claimed that I frequently expressed abolitionist views, and that when it came to the publication of such sentiments, he must offer his unqualified opposition. The court granted the divorce. My journal of a residence on a Georgian plantation was published in London and in New York. What's past is prologue. What's to come is now in your discharge.
I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on If you don't go, don't hinder me.
Don't hinder me.
If you don't go, don't hinder me.
Don't hinder me.
If you don't go, don't hinder me.
Don't hinder me.
I'm on my way. I'm on my way.
Probably interesting to know that the singing by the Sea Island Singers is based on music which probably was actually sung at the time of Fanny Hemingway, because the Sea Islands, just they're isolated off the coast of Georgia and South Carolina, and they've retained the music, and in the 1920s woman who was living there started collecting the songs and helping the people to preserve the music because they were
my question out of that, what did it do to you to be this actor? Yeah.
Oh.
About slavery and not just Fanny Campbell. But.
I can never go back to the material without just getting terribly upset. It tears me apart. And, you know, it's something that I do occasionally continue to do some research on. I mean, I just bump into things. And also because the play is being done, I sort of keep up to date on any research on Fanny Campbell. But there are things like in the Lenox Library, the Lenox Public Library, there's a photograph of Alexander, of the man she taught to read. I mean, it says a man. It says Alec in later life. And, you know, you come across that sort of thing in a library and it's devastating. I mean, they're real people and they went through such excruciating pain. I don't know. I don't know what to do with it. I mean, I just cry. That's all that happens to me. I think I did all the reasonable things I could do with it to make it into a play and, you know, deal with it in a kind of objective way, and the only objective way I know, but it still just knocks me out. The people are very real and for me, and I often see people who I think, oh, you know, that's Psyche. My Psyche must look just like that. And Ned the engineer. It's very vibrant in my life. I don't know what all that interest comes from. It may be because, I mean, I just had an ordinary North American childhood in the Northeast. But then I went to Cuba, and I went to high school in Cuba, and it was much more mixed racially than we are, even in the 1940s. And although it wasn't, you know, it wasn't an ideal place, and it wasn't integrated all the way through in society and economically, still there was much more mixture of races than I'd ever experienced in the Northeast. And culturally, I mean, the music in Cuba is Afro-Cuban music, and the art is. And so I was very aware of the richness of that kind of society. And then when I came back to this country and finished high school in Los Angeles, I read a lot about slavery and about the South and about what we were attempting to do then with the NAACP and that kind of thing. It politicized me to a certain extent. I supported Henry Wallace, that kind of thing. But I think that's probably what the interest comes from. I mean, it's more than an interest. David once said the thing that is most profoundly, David Klein and Ruth McPhee and I worked together, Paul O'Connell worked together with a company called Playworks, and so we know each other quite well. It's the most important thing I think about when I think about this country, which is true. But it stays very personal.
Yeah.
I don't get very abstract.
Anybody have any questions about anything? And what we had planned to do is as I mentioned at the beginning, is just kind of flow through this and flow through perhaps some excerpts from the narratives. But maybe it's okay to preface all that with a phrase that we need to get a hold of somehow. And on the kiosk it says, we can't escape our slavery. We can't escape our history. Another way to put that is to ask about the legacy of slavery. And even in what you saw there, are there connections in your mind that you make with the experiences that you've had regarding racial matters? If not, I'm ready to go if we don't have that kind of idea. But do you have those kind of questions? How does this apply? What we saw this takes place in the 1830s and 40s. And as I tell all my literature students, criticism or analysis or questions have to begin from the guts, not from your head. If you start from your head, you get all uptight and, you know, ooh, I don't want to ask the right question. If you start from your guts, your emotions, that's where literature and I think art are best begun.
The line that struck me, that's the first time I've seen it, today was the one about when she talked about there being a slave uprising and the white people being killed, and why does that? The question obviously was, why doesn't this happen? Since the numbers are so overwhelming, and it, which reminds me of the Holocaust. You know, mm-hmm. why did people go into the ovens? You know, why did people not resist? And I just, that was just a very strong parallel that hit me in listening to it now. And of course, I mean, I do think that's a really interesting question, because I mean, there were plenty of slave revolts. There were plenty of instances like that where there were not. But the, you know, we don't know from the video what might have happened or what slaves might have heard about. I mean, would they have, they'd come in and the whites would have come back in and massacred all of the slaves there? What would the consequences have been? Did they know that, or was it just, you know, what was the
they
real means
know.
Of social control?
They didn't know. That was one of the reasons that they were adamant about not letting them
right.
learn how to read and write. Yeah. And they were terrified there in that part. The whites were terrified that they would learn about upheavals in the West Indies and in Haiti. You know, they were afraid somebody would sail in and say what had happened.
Probably most of the people have heard of the Nat Turner, you know, the revolt in 1831, and the white people's response to that was, most of all, don't let this get out, because it was somewhat successful. 64 white people were killed, and but they squelched it right away, but it took a while to get it squelched, I mean, the revolt itself, but then to squelch news about that was really an important thing to support that, because if there was a glimmer of hope out there that this could succeed, we're going to have all kinds of revolutions, especially when it's, what is it, 400 to 1?
700
to 1, yeah.
700 to 1.
Why don't they? And it's analogous also to the what they call them, the capos, the Jews in the concentration camps who carried out the orders and ran the show just like the
yep.
black driver. That here's an interesting response that Frederick Douglass gives about that. I mean, it's only one response, and it could, you know, but about why people don't leave more often, and he's talking about not only revolting but just escaping, and well, just listen to Douglass. Here were the difficulties, real or imagined: the good to be sought and the evil to be shunned. The good is the freedom; the evil is to get rid of slavery. The good to be sought, the evil to be shunned. On the one hand, there stood slavery, a stern reality, glaring frightfully upon us. Its robes already crimsoned with the blood of millions, and even now feasting itself greedily upon our own flesh. On the other hand, away back in the dim distance under the flickering light of the North Star, behind some craggy hill or snow-covered mountain stood, underline it, a doubtful freedom. Half frozen, beckoning us to come and share its hospitality, this in itself was sometimes enough to stagger us. But when we permitted ourselves to survey the road, we were frequently appalled. Upon either side we saw grim death, assuming the most horrid shapes. Now it was starvation, causing us to eat our own flesh. Now we were contending with the waves and were drowned. Now we were overtaken and torn to pieces by the fangs of the terrible bloodhound. We were stung by scorpions, chased by wild beasts, bitten by snakes, and finally, after having nearly reached the desired spot, after swimming rivers, encountering wild beasts, sleeping in the woods, suffering hunger and nakedness, we were overtaken by our pursuers. So escape or revolt, you get it. And in our resistance, we were shot dead upon the spot. I say, this picture sometimes appalled us and made us, he's quoting Hamlet, rather bear those ills we had than fly to others that we knew not of. I just read that again this morning and was reminded that in the book of Exodus, the Hebrews say to Moses, after all those incredible miracles, you know, and Moses has really been snapping his fingers, getting some hot stuff done, Moses, it'd be better to die back there in slavery than it would be to die out here in the wilderness. And that's not just an English teacher looking at it. They say that three times, and after you hear it a while, you got to think, maybe there's something to this. You know, rather bear these ills than fly to those we know not of. I heard a voice or something, didn't I? Another thing that that he talks about in here, and this is a little different than the revolt, but about escaping, is that they've got to leave people they love, and they're not going to do that. On the other hand, there are countless numbers of escapes that suggest what people are willing to do for freedom. I would sure recommend to you, this is a great book, and because it's just so clearly stated, and it's through the eyes, as one ex-slave says that when he talks about slave narratives, it is the eye. Slavery must be told about by the one who has endured, not the one who was looked on. And I asked Annie about that. Is in a way, Fanny Kimball has looked on. She hasn't endured. But on the other hand, she's endured some things through her own sensitivity. And
right. Because she was an actress, she knew how to put herself into other people's shoes and did. She was a very emotional person. More emotional than I am. I mean, she was really tempestuous and passionate. And so she had a way of empathizing in a very powerful way. And she was also a trained observer because she was an actress and because she'd done a lot of writing. So those skills held her in good stead. But, you know, it wasn't her back that got beaten when people were beaten.
And one of the things that I think, that when you hear the white woman talk, and I noticed this with her when she started, she was astonished that this one guy, because of his color, came up and said, I want to learn a trade, and my father is white, and she's so astonished about that. Until you get into the slave narrative to hear what the profound spiritual and emotional effects of that are on the black woman, and Incidents of the Life of a Slave Girl reveals that. She is a light-skinned black woman who is apparently, as she describes herself and admits, attractive, mm-hmm. and physically and sexually attracted to her owner. And he comes up and he whispers in her ear, and it's a lot of what we would call, of course, sexual harassment, and even more now. And she, because of her moral convictions, not necessarily because her master's ugly, though apparently he is, but her own moral convictions, I'm not going to submit to this. And he keeps coming, and finally he decides, I'm going to build a cottage for you, and I'm going to put you out in that cottage, and you will be my servant, you know, my mistress, okay? And she just can't do this. So she has an incredible moral choice. This has nothing to do with, well, you'll get the point. This incredible moral choice to make, do I live like a queen among slaves and serve my master, or do I live with my own morality resist all this, but then probably be put out, as she's later told, be sold down to a plantation. I'm going to sidestep for a second. I've read lots and lots of slave narratives and lots of the real short ones, and in all of them, every single one, the most common fear is not to be whipped, not to be raped, but to be, yes, sold. That's the one. So when she has that threat over her, she makes a choice, and she finds. And this goes against her moral code, too, and that's clear in the book as she develops her own sense of values. She befriends a black freedman and by him has a child. And she goes up to her white master and says, you can't touch me, I am with child. Well, he's infuriated, but worse for her, is her grandmother's response to that. You what? And they can't believe that she would have sex outside of marriage, even for the reasons that the motivations that she has for that. And listen to this, how she responds when later on suffering, she wants to reconcile her relationship with her grandmother. She calls for her grandmother to come to her. She came at last. I knelt before her and told her things that had poisoned my life, how long I had been persecuted, that I saw no way of escape, and in an hour of extremity I had become desperate. She listened in silence. I told her I would bear anything and do anything if in time I had hopes of obtaining her forgiveness. I begged of her to pity me for my dead mother's sake, and she did pity me. She did not say, I forgive you. But she looked at me lovingly, with her eyes full of tears. She laid her old hand gently on my head and murmured, poor child. Poor child. And the language of that is a different kind of response to the whole process that we see on Roots and Queen, worst of all. Is that what the name of it?
Yeah.
The series on Queen?
Yeah.
The incredible spiritual and theological ramifications of that kind of treatment in slavery. It's good stuff, you guys. It's in the library.
Yeah,
I've said it three times
now. It's fascinating because she knows about romantic love, and she talks about romantic love in that book. I mean, it isn't as if she doesn't understand.
She does.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Well, and later she falls in love with this guy who, I mean, she does love this guy, yes, who gives her the two children. And but it'll never be.
Right.
Because he's free, she's black. I mean, and she's a slave. He's black.
Is that also a contemporary king?
Yes, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
That's,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's hard to trace that. Well, it's easy to trace whether they're. She's published in 69, it's after the Civil War.
Yeah, she was published at the very end of the Civil War, and yeah, she didn't, she had a lot of friends in the abolitionist, Fanny Kemble had a lot of friends in the abolitionist movement, but she was never politically active in the abolitionist movement. She actually was very worried about abolition and was afraid that if everyone were free without having education, that they wouldn't be able to cope. She had been, you know, there was a great reform movement going on in England as she was growing up, and so she was very aware of what the difficulties were. And she was not a militant abolitionist, but she thought things should be very different than what they were, and she didn't think that one person should be able to own another. And she was reluctant, although her abolitionist friends urged her to publish the journal that she had kept, which was in the form of letters to a friend in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. She didn't want to publish them, partly because she tried to save her marriage for a long time, for 10 years after this. And she thought that perhaps she didn't really have the right to publish them since she was, in effect, a visitor at the plantation, at least that's what she said. And I think she was really worried about her husband taking her children away from her, which he threatened to do, and he did get custody of them. But she was caught in some of these same binds. Mm-hmm. So she didn't publish it although she distributed it kind of freely among her friends, which is a bit like preaching to the converted. But she did publish it at the time of the Civil War, and her thought was that it would help to sway English people toward the Union cause because they were basically pro-Confederate because of the connection to the cotton. They wanted the cotton because they had the cotton mills in England, and so they needed the cotton from the South, and they were inclined to support the South rather than the Union side. So she wanted to show that the horrors that slavery did cause. So it was published then, but it came too late, and it never really had any effect. And then it was published afterwards in this country. And there's very little information about the impact that it had in this country. I mean, by that time, the Civil War was over. And there's very little information. I've never found any reviews or seen any reference to the reviews or what happened when it was published here. So, it really kind of lay dormant until maybe 20 years ago when American scholars started reading it and started believing it, because what had happened was that historians had said she was just an emotional actress and she just made this stuff up. She made up, for example, that there were four camps on the island. Well, we now know, because airplanes have flown over and taken photographs with infrared film, that there were four camps, and they're now doing digs in those four camps, and they are finding evidence of things that she described, including something she didn't describe, which is very interesting, which is guns. So they have found some guns in the digs that belong to slaves. Mm-hmm. And they were not, of course, permitted to have guns, even to hunt.
And they're not converted?
Well, presumably not, because it's in those camps. It's, you know, it's in the sites where the camps were, that which were the villages, the black village.
I wrote that on the board because one of the legacies of slavery is that we don't believe the power of racism and the evil of racism today any more than we believed it then. And that's Douglas, it's interesting, when he first published, and it's in everything that's published now too, has to have it kind of okayed by William Lloyd Garrison, who's a white guy, to kind of say, hey, I want you to know this stuff is true. That's what prefaces this thing.
And
this,
yes, go ahead.
And this too, The Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, is really written by a woman named Harriet Jacobs. And she writes under the pseudonym of Linda Brent, and she does that to kind of cover up herself, because she's free in the North, and she wants to stay safe, and she's being hidden by abolitionists. And she's safe, but in a way, at any time, you can go back. Being free, being bought out of freedom, for whatever reason, you can still be put back, of course, into slavery. Well, this don't believe. This then comes out, I think, again, it was first published in 1845. It kind of gets lost. Partly, I suspect, I'm not a scholar on this part of this, but because she's a woman, whereas Frederick Douglass survives, and other slave narratives by men do survive. This comes back, and I'm guessing it was about 1984. Mm-hmm. But before it could come back, another scholar, and the first time I read this, it was in a book about this thick, where every name in here that is fictionalized has been researched through court records and birth certificates and medical records to validate that these things, these names, whom she has hidden, Mr. Covey is not really Covey, it's somebody else, but it all fits together historically. And the woman that edited this book when it first came out again includes all of that research within footnotes, my point is, to verify it. And I thought, as I listened to you say that, and I put these two together, and then I reminded again of the Holocaust, one of the things that happened again and again in the Holocaust is that people would somehow go away, see what's going on, come back and tell them, and they say, no way, that can't be true. And, I mean, read Elie Wiesel's Night, and where the beetle, he gets caught somehow, miraculously, gets out, comes back and says, hey, they're putting Jews in boxcars, and they're taking them off, and they're, don't tell us, you're crazy, the man is crazy, they don't believe him. And as I listen to people and my own work with racial matters, oh, come on, it's not that bad. Oh, come on, that's not a racial, it's something else. And part of that legacy, I'm connected now, is we just don't believe it. Unless some white guy verifies it. Which is telling too, yeah.
Or, you know, to kind of continue what you're saying, or, yes, the slavery happened, but there isn't really the legacy, the ongoing pain. You know, it was like slavery happened or the Holocaust happened, but there hasn't, but in today's world, that hasn't filtered down, it doesn't exist, or the pain or whatever caused what happened from it doesn't exist.
You know, that's a great observation, and we could connect now to then quickly, I mean, in an hour, by we've just done part of it. You see that video and you get awakened. Watch one series of Eyes on the Prize, and if you haven't seen that series, rent it. Please, it's just an awesome story of the civil rights movement in the 50s. And then you see America's apartheid in its clearest form. And then just get any kind of video about civil rights now, and you begin to establish some connections that are there. And one of the things that dawns on me as a student and teacher of this stuff is that the only approach, especially I think, that white people can take to grasping this is a radical one. Because I don't necessarily mean we have to burn down houses, but maybe. Radical, I mean, in the sense that all of our institutions are infused with this racism that is a part of the legacy of slavery. And I don't want to necessarily have the last word, but I'll let Douglass have, we're getting close to that, the last word. When he talks about, since we all care about this, the church at the end of his narrative. And just... This is what I mean by radical. He's ranted and railed quite a bit against the Christians in the narrative. What I have said respecting against religion, I mean strictly to apply to the slaveholding religion of this land, and with no possible reference to Christianity proper. But listen to how he defines that. For between the Christianity of this land, this is what I mean by radical and institutions being infused with racism. For between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference. so wide that to receive the one as good, pure, and holy is of necessity to reject the other as bad, corrupt, and wicked. That's quite a statement about institutions and in the institutionalization in the church of not just slavery, as he's talking about, and how it supported that and affirmed slavery, but of racism in today's institutions.
And yet the church carried the civil rights movement of the 60s. The Christian church I'm talking about, I'm not talking about any particular denomination.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say? I mean, if there was an institution associated with it, you know, there were Robert Kennedy and a few people in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, and of course, Lyndon Jones played a role, but I'm mm-hmm. talking about getting people in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
When you say the churches played the lead role.
Black churches.
Black churches,
white churches, hey, white
I think it's ambiguous them. Because the, and maybe even, not just ambiguous, but I'll think of a word as I go, maybe. The churches provided people who did march in the streets and who did proclaim their hope for justice and real freedom.